thanks to Misoma for sponsoring the first series of The Making Of. Every piece of a woman's jewellery tells part of her story. Earrings she bought with her first paycheck, a pick-me-up present from her best friend after a crappy breakup, the matching bracelets they got on that wild holiday, her 18th birthday, her 30th birthday, an anniversary gift she'll never forget. From past loves to career milestones, from morning to night, we wear our treasured moments, whatever shape or size. And Misoma is here for all those moments. They're on a mission to build a more confident, creative, and collaborative world, starting a chain reaction, one link at a time. Make your moments last forever with Misoma and get an exclusive 15% by using Make15 now on Misoma.com. You're listening to The Making Of, a brand new podcast from the female lead. I'm Bea Appleby, and in this series, I'll be talking to some of my favourite women about the moments that have made them. We'll talk about the highs and the lows and the turning points that have shaped their lives. But don't worry, I promise we won't call them journeys. My guest this week is the comedian, writer, actor, presenter and national treasure, Mel Giedroyc.
Sue actually had to pull me away from Mary Ann's Midnight Mocha flan. I literally had eaten about 8 slices of it. She said, mate, I think you've actually eaten it.
Best known as part of the Mel and Sue double act, they started out doing live sketch comedy, then moved into acting and presenting, culminating in 7 years hosting the phenomenal Great British Bake Off. Mel has also written 2 books on motherhood and has just finished her first novel, The Best Things, which is out early next year. We talked about her secret steely determination, the importance of female friends, and what it's like to suddenly be broke. Mel is just as funny and charming as she seems on TV, and I'm sure you'll want to be her best friend by the end of this, just like I did. So, here we go. Mel Giedroyc, national treasure.
Oh, that always worries me, because when I hear that, I just think, very, very old. Very old. Some dusty old, you know, something kept in a museum and only brought out on high days and holiday.
A lovely old national treasure. Thank you so much for being on the Female Lead podcast.
Oh, I'm delighted and honoured. Thanks for inviting me.
And for choosing 6 moments that have brought you where you are today.
Yeah.
How did you feel about picking them? Was it easy?
Do you know what? I was a bit worried because I suddenly realised they're mainly either failures or just really narcissistic showbiz moments. And they all sort of slightly fit in that kind of what a plum box, as far as I'm concerned. I do think failure, though, I don't know what you think about this, but I've been thinking about this. I think failure is a really important thing.
Absolutely.
To have to go through. I embrace it, which is good because there's been a fair few. But it's character building, I think. As long as you don't actually get destroyed by it, I think, you know, you do get stronger.
Absolutely. Only by finding out that you can survive it do you get the confidence to actually do anything.
Absolutely.
So moment number one, and you probably can't, is this one of your narcissistic ones?
This will be a narcissistic
okay.
one. Yeah, this.
Okay.
So we grew up outside Leatherhead in a little cul-de-sac, a new build cul-de-sac from the late 60s, and my mum and dad moved there, and it was a very sort of formative 11 years that I lived there before we then moved on. And the highlight of the year, the highlight of the decade, was always going to see Panto at the Thorndike Theatre in Leatherhead, which I hope and pray survives the current coronavirus, because it's a lovely little theatre. And we only really went to the theatre once a year because it was quite expensive, but we always went to Panto, and that was a pretty important moment in my life.
Really?
Yeah.
So was there one particular Panto that you think is this moment where you realised the warmth of the stage lights? I want to be there.
I'm going to say Red Riding Hood. It was 76.
Really?
Yeah, 76. There were these lovely sort of cuboid orange stools that you could sit on in the bar area before you went in. I remember the honestly, it's so weird, isn't it, what you remember from childhood?
Yeah.
I remember the feeling of my buttocks making contact with the spongy orange on top of the cuboid 70s stool. And I had a Coke in one hand, which we never had at home.
Right.
Ever had fizzy drinks at home. Again, you know, waste of money. Mum wouldn't do that. So you had, oh, it was just the best feeling in the world. A glass of Coke, you sat on the orange cuboid stool in the foyer of the Thorndike Theatre Leatherhead, and you knew that you were going to have 2 hours of just absolute the best fun you've ever had in your life. I remember it so vividly. It was the community song where, you know, there's always that bit in the panto when they pull down
words
on a big roll of paper, they roll them down from the ceiling. And this particular year, I remember really vividly because they said, well, would anyone like to come up? You know, anyone want to come up? Mm. I was up on that stage. I was like, I was like one of those women at the jumble sale, you know, it was elbows. It was just all elbows. I was pelting. I'd never run so fast in my life. Up the steps, up those sacred steps that they put down, you know, that bridge
between
the stage and the audience that weren't normally there. And it was this kind of secret portal into the world. And I just remember standing up on the stage about aged 8, right at the front, of course.
Right
at the front. Feeling, as you said, you know, this kind of warmth, this addictive warmth of those lights coming down. And it was, yeah, I think from then on, I think that was it.
And were your parents supportive of the idea of you being a thespian?
Do you know, they really were. They were so tired by the time that I came along, number 4. They really were. They were so battered down and exhausted. I think they just thought, yeah, whatever. Yeah, just do whatever you want.
Very like.
They were absolutely brilliant. I mean, I think they found it quite amusing, you know, and they witnessed firsthand, I suppose, the awful ups and downs. And my God, there have been some downs as well as ups. They saw all that at close hand. I'm sure at times they were worried, but they were absolutely supportive, and they were always of the feeling that, you know, if it makes you happy, if you love doing it, then just go ahead and do it, which is incredible, really.
So let's move on to moment number 2, which now we've gone from the narcissistic moment to now a failure. This is a sad one, yeah. Failing to get a part in the school play, age 14. What happened, Mel?
Oh, the pain, my darling. No, I was known at school, I'm not going to lie to you, as a bit of a wag. Little bit of, you know,
right.
The person piping up with the odd, you know, the odd little gaggette here and there. So anyway, school play, a major event.
Right.
Red letter day when those audition lists went up at school. Mm-hmm. They were doing, I mean, it was a ruddy dry play. It was The Winslow Boy by Terence Rattigan.
Oh God, I thought you were going to say Grease or something.
No, it was The Winslow Boy. It was a slightly academic school, and they loved to pull out a sort of really dry, totally inappropriate, really. So these ruddy audition lists went up for The Winslow Boy, and I went in. There was no comedy roles, nothing. It was dead, actually. It was embarrassing and dead. I was never that good at sort of, you know, doing straight dramatic stuff. Really not my bag. Anyway, got the knockback, cried probably for about 2 days.
Oh.
You know, the school play was everything. It was the chance to just, you know, get your mates along. This is really, really naughty and actually narcissistic. This is the failure that turns into a terrible, terrible moment of narcissism.
Okay.
I suggested to Mrs. Davis, who was directing the show, I said, how about there's a maid called Violet who comes on at the beginning and sort of explains to the audience what's been going on in the household before the show starts. And Mrs. Davis sort of thought about this, and she said, oh gosh, yes, I think that's quite a good idea, because they were cutting some of the play.
So right.
Anyway, cut to me doing, it was a good tidy 10-minute monologue
Wow.
As comedy maid, Violet, the monologue grew every night. It was on for three nights, I think. I got my best mate involved as well. She was Rose. So there were these two maids discussing what had been going on. And I'm ashamed to say it became a sort of stand-up act.
Wow.
Yeah. And to the point where Mrs. Davis was kind of saying, now, Melanie, do you think this evening's performance, you might be able to cut it down ever so slightly? Because the whole thing was just overrunning. But that, I wormed my way in. I wormed my way in. And actually, I did really enjoy the writing of it. And I realised at that point, hang on a sec. If you can ruddy write your own material, if you can write your own stuff, then you can sort of do whatever you want.
Yeah.
Mrs. Davis had no blooming control. But it was brilliant, though. It was brilliant. Finding that writing was something, and I encourage any of your listeners, any of your listeners be who have, writing is the way forward, you know. Writing gives you power. You can do it anywhere. You can do it in your own home. You can do it with kids if you're not too exhausted. It's brilliant. If you have any grain of talent at writing, I would say just pursue it because it's brilliant. It's brilliant.
That is a very good message. I think it is. And I think there's a lot of people that just, there are lots of people that don't try because they have that horrible inner critic saying, what are you going to write that's good? What do you say to that? How do you get over that?
Every single writer you talk to, you know, whether they are the top novelist, you know, winning the Booker Prize, down to script writers, down to people just starting out, they all have the inner critic. Whenever I sit down to write, I have the inner critic going, why are you doing that? What are you doing that for? That's a bit rubbish. Someone's done that. That's not funny. Whatever. You just have to ignore it and plow on. It's all you can do. And I wrote a novel, which I'm just finishing at the moment, which I started last autumn. It was 10 years late. So it's been a bit of time in the brewing and the the arrival of it. It'll be out next spring. But and I went every day from September the 1st into our local library. We share the same local library.
We do.
And I went in there and I found being in a space which was not my home really useful. I found the fact of having to get on my bike and go into the local library really, really good, actually. And
good
also
tip.
Yeah, definitely. I think having a deadline really helps. And I was lucky in that I had a publisher who was saying, right, we need this draft by this time, whatever. If you don't have a deadline, then get somebody to set you a deadline. You know, you get a friend or a member of your family or a colleague or whatever to say, okay, you keep saying to me, I'm going to write this, I'm going to write that. Right, I want to see something by this date. Mm-hmm. That's the only way that I could ever have done it. I don't know about you.
Absolutely, 100%. Completely. And I think another thing, as someone who does a bit of writing, is that you have to remember that everyone that writes thinks the process is appalling.
Everyone does.
No one likes it. So if you do it and you don't like it, it doesn't mean it's not for you. Everyone hates it.
Everyone hates it. But within the hatred and the boredom and the awfulness and the inner critic saying, stop it, what are you doing, you fool, you get those moments, you get those afternoons or those hours or whatever it is, or those days or those weeks when it is the best thing that you'll ever do. And for that reason, I think that's what keeps people doing it. Mm. You know, in a similar way to performing, you know, it's that kind of the addiction of the real high that you get doing it, which can be not that often, but my God, it's worth waiting for when it comes.
Yeah, absolutely. And to the point about, you think someone's written this before, a very sage female playwright said to me, Amy Rosenthal,
I love her.
It will always be different what you write because you've written it. And that's true, because even if someone's done a similar story, you're always going to have a different take
because it comes out of your head.
Yes, you're so right. I should remember that.
So the next one is, the next one is another cultural epiphany. This is your mum buying you and your sister tickets to see Cambridge Footlights.
Yeah.
What happened?
So this was, I was either 15 or 16. And mum bought these tickets to go and see this show. I'd never heard of this group. She said, I think this might be up your street. They're students, they write comedy sketches, and the goodies came from there. They started out in the Footlights, Monty Python, some of them came out of there. And I was very obsessed with the goodies and also with the Pythons. And I sat there, it was similar to the Thorndike Theatre in Leatherhead, but as a 16-year-old, this time in the Oxford Playhouse. And it was like a sort of road to Damascus moment.
Wow.
My sister said I was sitting so far forward in my chair. I was pretty much sort of in the lap of the row in front. I was just absolutely transported. And it was a student show. Hugh Dennis was in it, aged 19 or whatever, and his double act partner, Steve Punt. But there was this guy, Chris Luscombe, who played the main part, and he was just absolutely hilarious. There was something about him, it just really tickled me. It was a really sort of cozy persona. He was playing a dictator in a country. It was sort of set around this idea of it being a fictitious country and a dictator, but he was playing this very cozy dictator, and this just absolutely made me howl with laughter. And it was that performance in that show that year that really made me think, this is what I want to do with my life. I want to be in sketches. I want to do this. I want to be on a stage, and I want to be doing comedy. So those weird moments where you're in the right exact place at the right time, and that was it. I just thought, okay, I'm going to apply to Cambridge, and I want to be in the Footlights, and I want to be doing this for a living. Literally, that was the thought process.
And it was Cambridge for the Footlights. It wasn't Cambridge because it's the best you can get.
No, absolutely. I wasn't interested in that at all. It was for the footlights.
But in fact, you must have had a lot of determination to see that show and think, I'm going to do that. I'm going for it. I'm going to be in that. That's like realizing a dream quite brilliantly.
Quite weird, I think. But it's that thing you mentioned earlier, you know, when you're that age, you have no sense of fear or no sense of anything, really. So I think I was just in a sort of bubble in my head, just thinking, oh, that looks great, I'll do that, because you're that age, and at that age you think you can do anything.
But are you maybe quite determined? Is there a steely determination within you, maybe?
Yeah, no, I'm definitely a grafter, I think. Yeah, I've always loved earning my own money. I did that right from way, way young, when I was about 12 or 13. I always had jobs, always. It's always been really important to me to earn my own money.
Why? I mean, obviously, so you can buy things, but why was it particularly important to you?
I think because my dad came to this country age 17 with absolutely nothing, and having had a very, very tough time in a refugee situation in Siberia in the war.
Wow.
And he was Polish, right?
Yeah, Polish-Lithuanian. So
right.
I've sort of had that in my DNA and in my makeup, I think. So I've got this really complicated surname, Gedroych, which is it's a nightmare to pronounce. It's a nightmare to spell. You know, it is. It's a nightmare. But my dad always said that is the only thing I came to this country with, was my name. And so I think it's about sort of, I don't know, it's about making your mark in some way. Or, you know, I've never wanted to change my name. I'd never call myself Goodrich, for example, or anything like that. I don't know. It's just an idea of you're self-sufficient. You've only got yourself to answer to, and nothing will be given to you on a plate.
When your parents or grandparents were immigrants, there is a feeling of a duty to make something of yourself, isn't there, I think?
Exactly. And that can be a bit of a pressure, you know. Mm. I think maybe my brother, who's the eldest, and my elder sister probably felt that maybe more than I did, because they were the two eldest of the pack. But no, I think that's absolutely right. There is a sort of feeling of, well, you know, what are you going to make of yourself? You know, we came here with nothing. So what are you going to do?
And when you saw that Footlight show, So it wasn't stand-up comedy. It wasn't, hey, what's the deal with airline peanuts? It wasn't that kind of thing. It was silly, sketchy comedy. And that's the kind of thing you've always liked doing best. Is that right?
I think that's right. I think it was the cheekiness of it. It was the fact, I just couldn't believe that these guys and girls were students. I just thought, oh my God, that's so cool. They're not even professional actors, they're students, and here they are and we're paying to see them. That really sort of really struck a chord with me. And I thought, oh man, if there are people like that going to uni that I could be friends with and get involved with, that would be so much fun, because I've always enjoyed hanging out with people that I can laugh with, you know. That's the nature of friendship, isn't it? Yeah. Laughter's really, really a massive part of who I am and what makes me tick and stuff like that. So
and speaking of friendship,
yes,
and speaking of friendship,
oh God, do we have to bring her in?
But just briefly, at Cambridge you met Sue, which I guess is another watershed moment.
My God, massive. I mean, yeah, it's another of those, oh, if I hadn't got into Cambridge, or if she hadn't got into Cambridge, if we hadn't met, you know, it's just amazing that we met. And I would say, genuinely, I mean, there were really fantastic actresses there at the time that we were there, but probably the two of us were really, really the ones that were most committed to comedy. We sort of found each other, and our humour sort of clicked. And we were mates before we started doing any work together.
We're sort of getting ahead of ourselves, because we need to go back to moment four, which is not getting into drama school.
So
let's talk
God.
About that.
No, moment four, failing to get into drama school.
So I, for some reason, and Sue, I have to say, really, really rips the piss out of me for this. I thought for a crazy moment at university that I had done with comedy. And I thought, no, what I want to do is shave my head, wear a pair of urine-coloured pyjamas, which I did, and go around Europe in a bus doing a cross-gendered version of King Lear. And I thought, oh my God, I have finally found my true belonging. I am theatre. I am a mama. I am... You know, I got into experimental theatre. I'm not proud of it.
Why? How?
I think I fancied somebody who was in the show that I was trying to get into. I mean, it's so...
Do you know what? I was going to say that. Saoirse Lahom. Yeah.
Isn't it?
I mean, it's so... So many decisions in life.
Yes.
Sadly.
This was a classic. This was a classic CLH moment. So yes, I have to say it was only for about a year, but I veered off the true path, which is of course comedy, and into the very murky waters of experimental theatre, which took me up to the Edinburgh Festival in a couple of shows. And I thought, well, of course I must apply for drama school. You know, I was at university at the same time as Rachel Weisz.
Right.
And I looked to her and thought, wow, she's got it, man. She's got the poise, the looks. She's got the voice. She's got it all. I thought, right, I'm going to apply to drama school. And I did. I applied to Lambda, Central School of Speech and Drama. And there was one other, which now I forget. I applied to three of them. And I was soundly rejected by all three. Ooh. And I just thought, well, that's it. I'm never going to perform again. I remember getting into bed. I went home to mum and dad. Dad would come into the room. I got into bed with a duvet, literally the classic, over the head.
Yeah.
I was mortified. I was so embarrassed. I just thought, I've spent, you know, since I was about 12 thinking this is what I'm going to do. And it's not going to happen. I'm really embarrassed. I feel utterly humiliated. And he bought me little cups of whiskey.
That's a sad story, but also a sad failure story, because was it one of those times when actually it was something that was completely beyond your control? Maybe you just weren't that good at serious acting? Is that what it was?
I think what you're saying, B, is that I was shit, and you're right. I was never cut out. No, I wasn't cut out. I was not cut out. The monologue I did to try and get into Lambda B was a very, very brave, bold, experimental monologue, which I hadn't written, actually. It was written by somebody else, where I played Myra Hindley.
Oh.
Now, in terms of casting, is that a good choice? What was I thinking?
So are you saying it wasn't just talent, it was actually bad choices as well?
It was mainly the talent, I would say, but also some criminal bad choices. But you know what they say, you know, we were talking about this earlier, but failure can often open little strange little pantry windows. I'm not saying it was a full door, but a little window somewhere opened, and it you know, it was by I thank God I didn't go to drama school. I never would have started working properly with Sue. We never would have gone to the Edinburgh Festival. We never would have done our own thing, and I'd have been hopeless anyway. And I probably would have given up.
So then, I mean, that's a big thing, isn't it? What would have happened to you?
It's a huge thing. I think I might well have gone into nursing because my mum was a nurse, and it was something that I was always really interested in. But then again, I don't think I'd have been that good a nurse. I'm not good at night shifts, you know.
But you would have been jolly.
I'd have been very jolly, and I'd have had a captive audience.
You would.
On the ward. Right, no one's going anywhere, okay? So I'm going to do a tight little 20 minutes. Let's just wheel out the mic. Life's weird, isn't it? You sort of, you know, with the kind of the advancing years, the 52 years of being on the planet, you look back, actually. You have the kind of, I can't think of the word.
Hindsight?
Hindsight, thank you very much. Yep. Hindsight of being able to say... And the path that you're on at any given time, you just think, what the hell am I doing? And it's only with hindsight that you say, yes. Well, it was all mapped out. Of course it was supposed to be that way. Mm. It couldn't have been any other way.
And it all worked out for the best.
It did. I mean, you know, it took Sue and I a good 7 years after leaving university to get our first kind of proper break, which was doing Light Lunch on Channel 4, which was earning us money, and it gave us a proper break on telly. You know, it took us 7 years. And I'm not going to say that those 7 years were all fun and games. You know, we had precious little money and we were often thinking, what are we doing this for? Is this worth it? Let's give up, you know.
Yeah.
I think the fact that we had each other spurred us on and made us think, come on. And we always had such a laugh doing it, even when times were tough.
And why do you think you two have worked together so well for all these years?
Because we make each other laugh genuinely, and right. We feel a genuine affection for each other. It's a proper friendship, you know.
Do you ever fight?
We very occasionally have a really passive aggressive, we're terrible with confrontation, both of us, which is not good, actually. So if there's something brewing, then neither of us will want to deal with it. My voice usually goes very, very high and very jolly and very smiley, but there's a sort of slight grit in the voice, which Sue picks up from about 100 miles, and she just goes very shambly and looks down and covers her face. She does that kind of thing, and shambly mumbly. So that's not a good combination.
Right.
We do, thankfully, we're able to laugh about it.
I hope you're enjoying the podcast so far. I just want to take a minute to tell you a bit more about the female lead. We're a charity founded by Edwina Dunn, exploring the factors that limit women's success and fulfillment. By listening to women and understanding them through research and data, we aim to influence businesses and government to drive real change. We're passionate about telling women's stories, and that's what this podcast is all about. So please do rate and subscribe at the end. It will really help us to continue our work and tell more women's stories.
Having that friendship and that female, very strong female friendship that I've always had with Perks is just sort of, it's a real safety net, actually. You know what? Whenever the shite is hitting the fan, whenever life is awful, whenever things are down, you know, whatever, it's amazing having those kind of friendships, isn't it? It really, really is. I think a female friendship is a very, very unique thing. And I, you know, of course, guys have amazing friendships too. I'm not saying they don't, but there's something about... Maybe not.
I mean, they certainly don't talk as much about their feelings. I mean, in general. Do you feel like, so female friendships for you are a huge part of your life?
Really, really. And you know, yeah, absolutely. With my daughters, with my sisters, with my mum, with Perks, with my friends, you know, it's just what keeps you on the straight and narrow. Mm. I mean, I have really lovely guy friends, you know, really close friendships with guys. And, you know, of course, my husband is my total best mate. But there's something about just having a female friend, isn't there?
I think there is. And I feel that... as I've got older, and especially since I've had kids, that male friends, this sounds a bit sad, but there is a huge gap in their understanding of your life so much, I think.
Do you know what? Now that my kids are older, so now they're 16 and 18, I think you come back a bit more to your male friends. And I know exactly what you mean. When you're in your 30s or however old you are when you have your kids, you can be, it's like being a million miles away, isn't it, from some of those friendships. And you just think, you've got no ruddy idea.
What this is like.
Yeah. And they know they don't either. And actually, lovely, lovely Dickie O, he has said to me, well, it's not forever, is it? You know, when I said, I can't see you, I can't do anything, I can't even barely send a text, he said, well, it won't be forever.
Yes.
That's the kind of friend you need.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this brings us nicely on to moment 5, which is meeting Ben and the arrival of your daughters.
Oh, man. It was a setup. Mm. In a nutshell, it was a setup. They just thought, Ben and Mel, Mel's 30. She's had a string of pretty saucy, failed, dodgy relationships. Ben's 30. He's been in and out of a few slightly rum ones. Let's see if we can get them together. So they concocted this idea that we should get together. And there was an evening. I walked in and it was literally couple. And here's Ben. I just thought, nah, sorry, I'm too proud. I'm too proud. No, don't do this. I don't want anyone interfering. I make my own destiny. I do my own thing, blah, blah, blah.
The steeliness again.
Steeliness, the Lithuanian steel. I didn't talk to him all evening.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That must have been more awkward than talking to him.
Just awful. I mean, really awful. But we shared a minicab on the way home and he got out first. He was the first drop off. And I just thought, that guy is absolutely lovely. I'm a total flipping idiot. Why didn't I talk to him all evening? So that was that.
That's interesting.
And then we bumped into each other about 9 months later or 10 months later. I was heavily pregnant. No, I wasn't. In the back of that minicab, what he hadn't realised was, no, it was fate that brought us together after that initial slight blip. And I'm just so delighted that I had the chance to meet him. And I dread to think what kind of a pickle I'd be in now if I hadn't met him 20 years ago. But there was something about Ben, I just met him and I just felt... immediately comfortable, actually. I just thought, I feel so comfortable with this person. I've never ever felt this with anyone. And that was a big old thing.
And you thought, this is a man I could have children with?
Hell to the yeah.
How did having your daughters change you?
I don't think it intrinsically changed me. I think my default settings are probably the same as they always were. Mm-hmm. I hope it's made me a less selfish person. I hope it's made me a nicer person. It was hard at the beginning having to sort of choose between work and being at home. I found that really difficult, I'm not going to lie. because work had been everything, you know. And Sue and I together had had this amazing sort of run of a few years. We got our gig on telly and things started to happen and all of that. So that was, it was hard because I didn't want to be a mum who was just always out at work the whole time. I just couldn't have done that. I'd have been too depressed.
Yeah. At
the same time, I didn't want to be a mum that was always at home. Yeah. Oh, man, it's difficult, isn't it?
So that's the constant.
Fantastic.
And the guilt.
And you're in one, the guilt. So you're at work thinking I should be at home and you're at home thinking I should be at work. It's that, you know, we all have it, don't we? But with a very, very understanding partner, Ben, who has taken on just so much of the whole, you know, parenting thing. He's just been absolutely amazing. I don't think I could have done it otherwise. I think I probably would have just given up.
It's interesting talking to all these, talking to so many women who have found success, and those that have children, there's a pretty strong correlation between having a successful career and a partner who is doing their fair share, if not a bit more.
Man, seriously.
I mean, it's just not possible otherwise.
It's not ruddy possible. And full props to those women out there who are doing it on their own and managing a career as well. I mean, I just...
You said that once you've had a baby, people think you've died in the showbiz world.
Yeah.
Can you explain a bit more about that?
It's a very extreme thing to say. God, I must have been really feeling it at the time I said that. But I think in a sense, there is a truth to that. I think they just assume that you're not interested anymore. Well, Mel's got a baby now. Oh, so she's off doing that. No, she won't want, you know. You have to keep, you almost have to keep banging at the door even harder. And of course, you know what it's like. When you've had a baby, you don't feel the most confident. I felt mad for about 3 years. I didn't know which end was up. You know, I had moments of just thinking, I'm really lonely and I'm really just out of my depth and I don't know what the hell's going on. Luckily, you know, I've got lovely family and friends and, you know, I was very supported on all sides. But, you know, you feel very different in your skin, don't you, for a time, I think.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I remember once there was the woman came round to the door who was doing a survey. And normally you're like, nope, sorry, haven't got time for that, door slam. I was so lonely at that time. I was just like, I got her in. She wanted to leave. I was chatting to her for about 3 hours. She was desperate to leave. She was doing some, you know, marketing survey for washing powder or something. Desperate to leave. She had other people to talk to. I mean, you find yourself in some pretty dark, unusual places, as well as all the joyful amazingness of being a parent. So
you absolutely do. And you've actually written 2 books about motherhood, so you're kind of an expert.
Oh, God, not remotely an expert. I honestly can't tell you. They were just, actually, I really enjoyed doing those 2 books because I wrote them at the time when the kids were really, really tiny. And they kind of kept me sane because I felt I'm still writing and I'm trying to write some gags. Okay, they may not be top drawer gags, but I'm still doing it. I wanted to keep my sort of hand in, I suppose. But, you know, things have a way of just evening out, and you get your kids into school and then you realize you've got a bit more time for yourself and you know things I wouldn't regret a single day.
And how was it with Sue at that point? Did you feel, because I read that she said that she was worried that when you had your first child and that she didn't, that this was going to be a difficult moment for you. And I think for 2 female friends that are in that situation, it can be really hard because of that difference. How did you find it?
Absolutely. And she's very honest. And you know, I think I found it tricky at times as well, because I sort of felt, well, I've got to be at home. I've got 2 very, very young kids who I don't want to be away from for too long. I mean, you know, I did carry on working, but it was massively scaled back. And then at that time, you know, Sue was doing brilliant things and it was hard at times. I'm not gonna lie. It was hard at times. I would feel, oh God, I wish that was me, or oh man. But I think to be honest, I think we've always had, and we talk about this honestly, you know, you have to enjoy other people's successes, the other person's successes. Otherwise, you might as well just stop.
Yeah.
If you can't enjoy your double act partner's success at doing something on their own, you are screwed. Massively.
Right.
Because
right.
you will bring in so much bad vibery and sort of, oh, awful, awful, awful.
Mm.
So I'm sure there were times when I was thinking, oh no, I feel really sad that I'm not doing that too. But you have to bloody, you
yeah.
have to grit yourself through it. Obviously, when the kids got older and then we got Bake Off and then things start to, it's weird. Things
yeah.
started to just sort of pan out again. It's very odd. Very odd. I never would have seen that coming.
So that brings us on to the next part, I think, which is your final moment. Moment six, this is another sad, a failure one, but with a happy ending. Moment six, losing your house because you couldn't afford it anymore. This is when you were turning 40. What happened?
Oh, my days. So, oh, the world of showbiz, B. The world of showbiz. Madam Showbiz, she takes, then she gives in equal measure, doesn't she? So, kids were tiny, age 2 and 1. Mm. Sue and I had quite a lucrative little advert on the telly with a certain bread. It's called Kingsmill.
Oh, yes! I forgot about that.
We did the Kingsmill ads, which were, yeah, they were okay. But most important...
Nice little learner.
Mate, I wasn't earning any other money apart from
wow.
Kingsmill.
Wow.
Okay? I wasn't. And I was thinking, this is brilliant. Mm. I work for Kingsmill for what? 10 days of the year, something like that. Mm-hmm. And I get to be at home. This is absolutely
wow.
ruddy genius. Stupidly, we thought, right, got this great gig. Let's move into a really quite big house that we can't afford. And we're going to borrow a stupid amount of money to make it work.
Right.
And it'll all be fine, you know, because you do.
Yeah.
And so moved into a aforementioned house that was too big for us, borrowed all the money from the bank, and then I got a letter from Kingsmill saying, we will not be requiring your services anymore. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Oh no.
And then the House of Cards, the Gedroych finances, very much took a very, very quick crumble.
Oh, no.
A quick tumble. But all was okay. As I keep saying, you know, I've got lovely supportive family. We were never going to be out on the ruddy streets, were we?
Right.
I knew that, but it was pretty ruddy stressful. So we didn't go actually bankrupt, thank goodness.
Oh my goodness.
But we were very, very close to it, but we had to sell the house very, very quickly, which was tricky because the market was just going...
Oh no. So,
anyway, we got out just in the nick of time and we rented the magnificent 70s Love Nest, tiny little flat, 2 bedrooms with our then 4-year-old and 3-year-old.
Oh.
And we were never happier. We put all our stuff in storage. We didn't have a mortgage. We just paid rent and we were never happier. It was a big lesson, a life lesson. You've got to cut your cloth, you know, you've got to cut your cloth. Don't blooming strive after things that you can't afford, and it doesn't matter if you don't have a spare room or a back garden or whatever it is, you know, that you think is going to make you happy. Happiness comes from actually being together and getting on with each other. So it was a tough lesson, young B. It was a tough lesson.
That sounds like a tough lesson. And did you not have, I mean, practically it was fine, but did you feel, oh my God, we failed? You know, did you have a kind of beating yourself up moment?
Yeah. Well, it's the old snakes and ladders board, isn't it? I just felt I've climbed up this ruddy ladder, you know, for working, doing this. And now we're on a ruddy, great, big old slippery snake. And it happens very, very quickly. And you just go all the way to the bottom and you think, right, I'm back at square one. I've got no job prospects.
God.
You know, the kids are really tiny. I don't want to be, you know, flitting off somewhere. I'm not even getting any offers to do that anyway. Mm. It was quite tough. But, you know, I just got to grit the old teeth, and then you get offered this, you get offered that, and you've got to make what you can of it. And I started to do more stage stuff, actually, at the time, which I...
Right.
loved. So that was brilliant.
And then that's when Bake Off happened around then, is it?
God, crazy, craziness. Yeah, I think that was 2009.
Did you ever think it was going to be such a phenomenon?
I'll tell you what we thought it was. Mm. We thought it was the worst thing we'd ever done.
Really?
We were so embarrassed. I remember having filmed series one, Sue and I were on the phone to each other the whole time, just going, no one will see it. We paid some mortgage off. No one will see it. Don't worry. This will go so far under the radar. It is the tweest, naffest piece of rubbish. And my God, we've done some bad stuff, but this is really the nadir of the bad stuff that we've ever done. Genuinely.
Why?
Because the first series was very chaotic. No one really knew what the show was.
Right.
It was madness, actually. Mm. And you put four people together, so us and Mary and Paul together. We don't know each other. Suddenly we're not a double act. We kind of are, but are we? Mm. We loved them from the word go. We loved them to bits, and they were our saving grace in the kind of chaos. But it's hard. You're all trying to find your role within it, and you're all... I just thought, this is so boring. Who's interested in baking? this is like watching paint dry. Mm. This is waiting for a bread to prove 3 hours. It's actually worse. I'd rather watch paint dry. Do you know what I mean? We had no idea, B. Right. Honestly, I just thought, it's okay. I've earned a bit of money for the year. It's right. Okay. It's a one series wonder. No one will see it, and we can just move on. That's literally what I thought. It's madness what happened. It's madness.
And what now, with this wonderful hindsight, do you think was the secret to its success?
The kindness of it and the fact that the four of us got on so well. Simple as that. And let's be honest, you know, fair play to Anna Beattie, who was the woman that first came up with the idea for the show. Mm. It's a really good format, you know. Mm. It's a good format for a show. Who knew? I mean, the show goes on. It's all credit to Anna Beattie and her original idea that the show goes on. It's got new presenters, it's got new everything, new channel, but the show is still successful and it goes on. So full props to her. I mean, I look on our time of Bake Off as just seven really, really amazing years. Mm. Perfect. Wonderful job. Everyone seemed to really enjoy it. It was amazing to be part of such a big success. You know, we'd never had that before. Sue and I had never had that. Okay, we'd done other stuff, but nothing like that in our lives. Mm. It was a real privilege to be part of that. And I like to think that Sue and I created a kind of a vibe for the show. We didn't want it to be a kind of an unkind X-Factory sort of slightly predatory show.
Totally. And what you set has been taken, I think, sort of taken on by Sandy Toksvig and Noel Fielding, I think. It's a kind piss-taking, which I think is a lot of people don't really understand. It's nuanced, isn't it?
Absolutely. You've got to laugh with. You can't laugh at. The moment you laugh at, you haven't got a show anymore, I think. I've always thought. And we spent a lot of time with the bakers, Sue and I. Most of our job on that show was done not on screen. Really, really. We absolutely wanted to really get to know people. So then you feel very at ease with them. So then they tell you stuff.
Right.
So then they have a laugh with you. You know, that's the whole point of it.
That's so interesting. So that was the key to that feeling of warmth, but also being able to take the piss, was that they were your friends, basically.
Yeah. Well, also you feel secure with them and they feel secure with you. And they know, hopefully, that you're not going to sort of tie them up like a kipper and make them look stupid. Mm. That was never the intention.
Do you miss it?
I was talking to somebody about this the other day, actually. It's really odd. There's a certain time in April when it's quite cold, but it's sunny, and you can just see little crocuses or daffodils appearing. And that is exactly the time of year when we always started out filming on Bake Off. It was always April. It was always freezing. Mary had sort of body armor of hot water bottles, and it was really freezing cold. Mm. But there's just that moment, there's something in the air, and I get a little pang every year, and I think, oh, this time of year we would have started. But I also really believe that we had done our time. Actually, we had 7 brilliant years and we left on a high.
One really quick question, and then 2 even quicker questions. One really quick question is, just on the Bake Off, like, what did you do? Did you like never eat all day and this eat loads of the cakes? Or what did you do? How did you manage that eating aspect?
Okay, this is the absolute God's honest truth. Mm. Series 1, I put on a stone.
Okay.
Series 2, probably nearly a stone. Mm-hmm. We went berserk.
Really?
So it came to series 3, and Mary sort of, she didn't take us aside, but she did sort of say, I mean, girls, do you have to eat a big lunch as well as all the cakes on set? It was a very kind question. It wasn't sort of fat shame or anything like that.
Sure.
But so we started to follow Mary's lead.
Right.
Mary, every lunchtime, ate Heinz tomato soup, bowl thereof, and delicious Rye Vita crackers with some, you know, tomato and cream cheese on.
Right.
And that we found really, really helped. We'd been guzzling massive catering lunches as well as eating all the baked goods. I was very, very controlled for the first 5 or so episodes. Mm. I'd be really controlled. Mm-hmm. And like Mary, what she does is she just has a little tiny sparrow bite.
Yes, yes.
Whereas Sue and I would have a whole slice of something. So the first 5 episodes, and Sue would get a bit annoyed about this because I was a bit smug, and I go, no, it's okay, I'll just have a little tiny bit. No, that's fine. And then something happened every time. Episode 6, I would, that literally the floodgates would open and I would just be falling on hot water crust pork pies and, you know, 3-tiered banana waffle cakes from Siberia, or, you know, whatever it was. It was this weird thing. Sue actually had to pull me away from Marianne's Midnight Mocha Flan series, either 2 or 3.
Right.
I literally had eaten about 8 slices of it. It was the most delicious thing I'd ever put in my mouth. Flaky pastry and then half chocolate, half coffee.
Oh,
it was
wow.
Kind of extraordinary.
Yeah, it's lovely.
Tart. It really was delicious. And actually Sue, and she's never done this before, she said, mate, I think you've actually
Okay, 2 last quick questions. 1, when you look back and you think of a terrible cringe moment, what comes to mind?
I would say performing to 1 person at the Edinburgh Festival out of a folder because we hadn't quite yet learnt the lines. At 10 a.m. in the morning, that can wake me up at night with a twitching leg.
Isn't there a rule that if there's more people on stage than in the audience, you just have to shut it down? That's what I heard.
We didn't know that at the time, B. I think if we had, we would have made those measures very much happen. We had no idea. No idea.
And when you think back, or you know, when you try and think of happy moment, a purely happy moment, what comes to mind?
The girls' safe arrivals into the world.
Oh.
Just unbelievable. And I loved just meeting them. I loved meeting them for the first time. These 2 incredibly important people in my life. These magnificent, trying, exhausting, annoying, wonderful, brilliant people that I'm saddled with, hopefully till the day I die.
And that's the end. I hope you had a good time. Thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed this, please do rate and subscribe. This podcast was edited by Lauren Lind, and it was all brought to you by The Female Lead. If you want to know more about The Female Lead, please check out our website at thefemalelead.com, or our Instagram, or our Twitter, or Facebook, or TikTok, or LinkedIn, you name it, we're there for you.
See you next time.